Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
Today's show is sponsored by SeatGeek, the smartest way to buy and sell tickets. Use the promo code LOHEAT, that's L-O-H-E-A-T, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your very first ticket purchase. Now, on with the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm the editor at allyoucanheat.com. With me on the other line, yes, he's a hooper. It's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm hooping. That's what I do, man. You know, and despite the fact that I'm currently doing so in the midst of a hurricane, that's how committed I am to bringing out the very best for this Miami Heat team.
We're going to break down the top five power forwards in Miami Heat history as we continue along with our top five by position series. But first, we're going to start with the latest news. It's the Heat Check, and this time on the latest developments on Chris Bosh, who took to social media earlier this week in what some people are calling a social media blitz, him posting videos on Instagram and Snapchat of his workouts, one picture of him with Dwayne Wade saying, great workout. I mean, what are you making of all this, David?
Well, it's not just Bosh. It's, as you mentioned, pictures with Dwayne Wade to bring up a rather great sense of nostalgia, but also Adrienne Bosh, Chris's wife, she's also backing it up. And then with the, you know, being the particularly dry season right now in between the summer and no actual games taking place, it's easy to focus on this as a lot of news. But I think, you know, he wants to make it readily available that he is active. He's still working out. He's still a part of this team moving forward. A lot of people suggest that he might be using it as a means of trying to get the team to kind of force their hand a little bit to acknowledge that he is a part of their roster, because we've heard some trade rumors, possibilities that he may not be with the team, but here he is showing that he's active, he's capable, he's physically ready to play this season. So it looks like he's making a pretty strong push. I don't know how seriously we can take it, but he looks like he's in good shape, and he seems like he is ready for the season.
Yeah, I mean, he had an initial push before the playoffs last season in April, right, where he was taking Adrienne brought the hashtag bring Bosh back and et cetera. But that only lasted a couple days, and they dropped it, you know, once he was, you know, not cleared for the playoffs. So I wonder, is this an organized attempt? Is this really a public relations blitz on the Bosh camp? Or was it just something that kind of grew out of frustration, that he was just like, you know what, I'm sick of this. Nobody's seen me play in a long time. I'm going to post some videos. I'm going to post a few pictures. I do wonder how organized this is, or if you'll fold so easily like he did basically, or he was forced to essentially in April. And if this really means anything at all. I mean, it's good to see him practicing cone drills and pull-up jumpers and mid-range shots and sinking them and doing all that stuff and seeing him in the gym, but we knew that he was doing that already, so that's not really news. I think the news element here is that, you know, there's been media reports that he's starting to get even more frustrated, and we're like only a month away from training camp starting, like, and we really don't, like, the news is that there's really no news, that we don't know what's going on with him, and that just, the closer and closer we get to it, the weirder it gets, and all that coupled with Mickey Arison's retweet of that picture of him and Dwayne Wade saying some I'm paraphrasing, but looking good, can't wait to see you in training camp, basketball emoji. Like, what the F does that mean?
it is a little disingenuous, right? Because you think if anybody would know what's going on, it's probably the team owner, who's very, very close to Pat Riley and is very well aware of what's taking place there. So maybe it's just a little bit of PR on both their sides. I think from Bosch's perspective, he wants to remind NBA fandom at large that he is still an active player. You know, he's been largely overlooked. I think when you look at this team, and, you know, now as projections are taking place and the Heat don't look like one of the strongest contenders in the Eastern Conference for a reason after they lost Wade. Maybe Bosch is letting everybody know, look, if I'm there, I'm still going to be leading this team. I'm going to be doing the things that I've always done, the things that will get me at some point in the future into the Hall of Fame. And then from Arison's perspective, he doesn't want to look callous considering they've just arguably pushed their greatest player in franchise history away from the franchise. So, you know, Arison has always been, you know, kind of like a fatherly figure type. I think a lot of fans see him in that sense. And, you know, he loves his team. He's always been honest and open about his love for the team. So for him to tweet at Bosch like this, you know, a little vocal support probably makes him seem very kindly, I think, especially in light of what happened with Wade earlier this summer.
Yeah, I mean, that retweet's all fine and good, but I think it's a PR move. Like, we haven't heard anything specific in like 5 or 6 months now. And a retweet here and Mickey Arison mentioning him in that press release, you know, just kind of passively. I mean, like I said, we're a month away from training camp, dog. We need information. We don't know what's going on, but I know whether or not he's playing or not, training camp's going to happen. The Heat season's going to start. And I know you have some information for us, David, on that.
Absolutely, yeah. For all of our listeners, I wanted to talk a little bit about SeatGeek. SeatGeek and Locked On Podcast Network have entered into a partnership here, but it's something that I really feel proudly to talk to you about because SeatGeek makes it easier than ever to get tickets for your favorite games and concerts. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's really easy to use. The other day, I used it to look up concert tickets to go see Phish later on this month in Jacksonville.
Nice.
And I'm really excited about that. The app is very easy to use. It makes life so easy for fans to download and get the tickets that they want. You basically just download the app, and then it does all the work for you. It compares price tickets. It looks at different sites to ensure that you're getting the best possible deal, and it helps you get the most bang for your buck. Every ticket is graded on overall value, and you'll immediately see the most underpriced seats there and find the best deals to fit your budget. And best of all, listeners will get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. It's really simple. All you do is download the app, go to the settings tab, and click on add a promo code. Enter the promo code L-O-H-E-A-T, that's L-O-HEAT, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. I tell all my friends and family about it with the upcoming season. When they want to go see Chris Bosh or whoever's out there for the Heat, SeatGeek is the way to go. So download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code L-O-HEAT today.
How many times have you seen Phish?
I'm probably about 30-something times.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I use SeatGeek to get Chance the Rapper tickets in October, and I'm staring at my ticket right now. I printed it off, even though you don't really need to print it off, but because I'll probably forget until the day before, I've got like a cork board on my desk, and I've just got it like October 22nd at the Greek Theater. So
that's exciting, yeah. I mean, look, the app is easy to use for all that, and when it comes to seeing Phish, you know what? This is nothing. 30 shows is very, very little. Like, I mean, you talk to fans at these shows, and there are some people that go on summer tour with them. Now, you know, this is Phish, I think what they call Phish 3.0. This is like a much later stage in their development, and they don't tour nearly as much as they used to, but there are people that have seen hundreds of shows, so I'm still a novice when you think about it.
You're still in your rookie year.
Something like that. Speaking of rookies, let's move back to some more Heat basketball talk, huh?
Some more interesting, like, the more, this is a very complicated process, right? And we keep getting reports, a little bit more clarification from guys that have been digging into this and maybe getting a quote here and there. But Barry Jackson, the Miami Herald reporter, who's been covering this probably better than anybody else.
I'd say so.
Ended up, you know, talking with Nate Duncan over Dunked On Basketball Podcast and Real GM and whatever else he's doing. He does a lot of things. But yes. Mentioned that unlike what we thought, where if Bosch had played in one game this season, the clock on that full calendar year since his last game restarts. And the reason that's significant is that if he goes a full year without playing, then the Heat could apply to have his salary wiped away from their salary cap due to a medical clause in the CBA. And Barry Jackson recently reported that's not true. It's actually 10 games that Bosch has to play in order to restart that clock and restart that process of a whole year. So Bosch can essentially play up to 9 games. And that's not even including preseason games. So that just kind of gums things up a little bit more. That just makes things even a little bit more complicated. I don't know if that's good news or bad news. What do you think?
I think it's good news for both. I think, you know, the way you look at it, Bosch certainly wants to be out there. I think the media blitz and his workouts and just the fact that he's a superstar athlete that's been doing this for the better part of his life, he wants to be out there. I don't think there's any denying that. You know, we saw that push last year during the playoffs. We're seeing it now. He wants to be out there. He wants to be part of that camaraderie, the part of the team building that he enjoys so much. He's always talked about that. So I think he wants to be out there. From the team's perspective, if they're looking either to keep a superstar player or move on, they want some clarification. They want something concrete. And I think these nine games is a good test because we'll be able to see whether or not Bosch is able to move on, whether or not he's able to travel with the team, whether he can continue to take the abuse that comes with the life of the NBA player. And then not only that, but we'll also be able to see if any kind of new blood thinners or any kind of medication that he's taking works well, if he's tired, if he's able to keep his wind up. And, you know, it's tough because it'll be the start of the season likely when Bosch is available to play if he's cleared. We still don't know if that's going to happen. But if he's able to do it, you know, he'll be able to get into game shape and see his progress. And, you know, ultimately, he might be the one to say, you know what, I'm not progressing at the level I'm capable of. I'm going to be a shell of the player I once was. Maybe it's time to remove myself from the equation. And maybe he'll elect to retire rather than dragging it and making it an even messier divorce than what happened with Wade earlier this year. So I think it's a good thing for both parties.
I mean, the idea that he's got a handful of games to kind of test maybe a new medication or whatever it is, just to feel it out, that's good, right? And you can sort of get a sample size in that way. It just, there's so much kind of going on here. And if he does go a full year without playing, it's not as simple as saying, like, he hasn't played in a year, so medically he cannot play, so, and then the NBA just waives his salary off the cap. I mean, it's not that simple. It's, you know, the Players Association and the NBA have to mutually agree on one doctor, one physician who says his situation is so bad that it's not safe medically for Chris Bosh to continue playing basketball. But the odds of the Players Association appointing a doctor who's going to say that is 0%. That's not happening. They're not going to do that. And, you know, and especially because Chris Bosh has found doctors, according to Barry Jackson's reporting, you know, one or two doctors that have said, okay, no, there's a few medications you can take that would make it viable for you to play. And
now, hold on. I thought part of that was when it was first reported late last season that the doctor that was supposedly in agreement that he could play worked for the medication company that Bosch sponsors. So there's clearly some
okay. I don't know.
I thought that was the report.
But I'm just saying they're not. Obviously, that's probably a conflict of interest. But if Bosch has found a doctor, regardless, that has said that it's cool, like it's not. He must believe that there's other doctors out there that says it's cool, right? Like that's enough. I would think that's enough optimism to, and clearly it is because he still wants to play, right? So yeah. He thinks that there are doctors out there that are going to clear him. So that makes it even less. There's even less of a chance that the Players Association, Chris Bosh, would agree to appoint a doctor that's going to say, no, you can't play. So, you know, just this idea that all he has to do is not play for a year and everything's good for on the Heat side is not, like, it's not the case. It's going to get gummed up in that process, too, or you might need a mediator. It might turn into a legal battle. I mean, there's a chance that this gets really, really ugly. And as we've seen, even just with Dwayne Wade,
yeah,
things can get ugly regardless of who you are.
It's unfortunate, right? Because, I mean, Chris Bosh, when he chose to re-sign with Miami in the wake of LeBron's departure, that was such a great move. And you thought this was still going to be a team that was going to be able to contend, if not necessarily for a title. They were still going to be, you know, a strong playoff contender, and there was at least 2/3 of the big three still, you know, sticking around. And so much has happened between LeBron and Riley, and now Wade and Riley. And not to say that it's Riley's fault one way or the other. He pushed out Wade perhaps because he was towards the end of his career. Maybe the ultimatum he delivered to LeBron was too much. But, you know, with Chris Bosh, it's so hard to say because you want to believe that Riley and the Heat front office are in the right and that they're doing what's best for Bosch and his health. But if Bosch feels that he's capable of playing, and if he gets the kind of clearance that he thinks he can get, it does muddy it up considerably. It's a very sticky situation, and you're right. It has the potential to be a really messy divorce, and I just don't know what's going to happen, and I don't think anybody else does. And we're kind of stuck in limbo until we do, because this is a team that can move forward either with a full-on rebuild if Bosch elects to retire, or if they can just concentrate on developing their youth, or if they're going to have to change their plan of attack because they're going to have Chris there. And with a player of his versatility and talent, you know, you have to do things in a particular way. He's gonna command the same kind of touches that he should get. You know, a player of his caliber, the things that he can do. If he steps onto the court tomorrow and he's even at reasonably full to close to 100% health, he is the best player on that team, I would argue. And I think he's the one that would drive this team further than any other. So, there's a lot of different angles here, and we've talked about it on a number of occasions. I'm sure we will as camp opens next month and as we get closer to the start of the season. But that's all in the future. For now, I think it's probably better if we just move on and take a look at some of the best players in Heat franchise history.
Yeah, since we don't know what's going to happen in the future, I'll just go back and focus on what happened. Focus on what we do know. So I was texting you earlier, and I had some trouble with my list just because of the order. And you think that ours are going to be relatively similar. I said that they're going to be different last time, and they were almost identical for small forwards. But let's just get off with number five. I'll start. I got Lamar Odom.
Oh, you see? I told you. That's who I have at number five as well.
All right. You know us better than I know us.
I think we're both biased for one particular reason. And aside from whatever Lamar was able to contribute in a Heat uniform, it's the magic of that 2003-2004 season.
I mean, that one season, it's still amazing to me. Like, it feels like one season, but it doesn't, you know? I mean, that 2003-2004 season, you know, the Heat were able to sign Lamar Odom as a free agent. He was a huge get. And draft Dwayne Wade that same summer. I mean, if you talk about off seasons in Miami Heat history, if we did a top five off seasons in Miami Heat history, which might be a good idea in the future, 2010 obviously is number one, right? But this 2003 summer, that's right there. You know, that's certainly top three in Heat history, I would think, right? I mean, getting Lamar Odom as one of the biggest free agent signings at that time in Heat history. Just for you, because before that it was a lot of trades, right? Like, that was how the Heat got superstars. They finally were able to sign somebody that was considered an all-star, and then Dwayne Wade.
Yeah, that was huge. But I mean, you know, we talked about it with our shooting guard, you know, position breakdown. Nobody expected Wade to be the kind of superstar he was. We saw a really good performance from him at Marquette, and clearly the athleticism was there. But if you believe the stories that have come later on, Pat Riley really wanted to draft Chris Kaman. That would have been a pretty scary option rather than Dwayne Wade. We would have missed out on a lot of great basketball. But, yeah, you know, to get Lamar Odom there, to me, the great thing about that get, you know, to inform some of our listeners who might not be aware of it, I think you and I have talked about it in the past, but it's always a great story to me, one of the best in Heat history. It starts off with Donald Sterling and the Los Angeles Clippers. They were a team that was very young, had a lot of great players, a number of whom were entering restricted free agency at just the right time, 2003. They included Corey Maggette, Elton Brand, and, of course, Lamar Odom. So Pat Riley, in a genius move, extends an offer sheet for, I think, I don't even know, $80-something million, which was a huge deal at the time. It's still a huge deal, obviously, but it's a huge deal at that particular time, to Elton Brand. Brand was a player who was going to be able to fill in for Alonzo Mourning, who was, you know, now with New Jersey. He was going to be able to take over the forward center position. He was going to be able, you know, he was coming off some really good seasons as a Clipper, and he was really going to be able to help build the team to the next level. But surprisingly, a cheap bastard owner like Sterling matched the offer and elected to retain Brand with the Clippers. You know, unfortunately, Brand underwent a number of injuries. He was never quite that same player again in his career, although it was a long one, never reached that superstar level. So having matched the offer to Brand, all of a sudden Lamar Odom became someone that they couldn't necessarily afford to keep, and that's when Riley swooped in there and got arguably one of the best point forwards in NBA history, a guy who could dribble the ball, who could shoot from the perimeter, who could attack the rim, who had the length, the defensive ability, the passing ability, just so versatile. At 6'10", he was a hell of a player. And a lot of people have thought that Odom was actually Riley's target all along, and he was actually fleecing the hell out of Sterling, which I don't mind at all, by trying to extend an offer sheet to Brand. I hate to think of Brand being manipulated that way, although he got his money and he did get a long career out of it. But if Odom was the target, it was a smart move by Riley, and he wound up nailing it. He got a great player. Even for just one season here, it was such a great year. And just the way that he was able to play here, I always loved seeing Lamar Odom in a Heat uniform and just the kind of camaraderie, everything else that happened during that one season.
It's less a manipulation of Brand, I think, and more of manipulation of the system. And if we've learned anything in the Pat Riley era of the Heat, is he tries to find loopholes and kind of gimmicks that he can use in the NBA system to improve his team. Because if the Clippers don't match and they get Elton Brand, I'm sure Pat Riley's happy with that. Like you said, it's a guy that can come in and replace Lonzo Mourning. So I think in his mind, it's, all right, I'm either getting Elton Brand or Lamar Odom. And
it's not a lose-lose.
To play the system that way is nothing short of genius, right? It was a great move. Fortunately for the Heat, we got Lamar Odom. And in one season, you mentioned the point forward. I mean, his stats are insane. Can you imagine a 100% at strength in his prime Lamar Odom in today's game? I mean, 17 points, nearly 10 rebounds per game, and 4 assists per game in that one season at the Heat. I mean, just a guy that could do everything. A guy that could play anywhere between the 1 and the 5. I mean, listed as a power forward, though. Played power forward next to Brian Grant. I mean, on that 2003 Heat team. A team that ended up, I mean, I don't know how much we have to talk about it, but ended up going to the playoffs and just becoming one of our favorite Heat teams of all time. And if Lamar Odom never passes through Miami, even though it was just one season, I mean, his presence in Miami dramatically altered the entire course of the franchise, because it was with Odom that Pat Riley was able to put a package together to trade for Shaquille O'Neal. That trade never happens if they have Lamar Odom. It probably doesn't happen if they got Elton Brand, who, as you said, suffered injuries and was never the same. I mean, without Lamar Odom, Miami never gets Shaq. They never win the 2006 NBA Finals, probably. I mean, who knows how the rest of Dwayne Wade's career plays out. If LeBron ever decides that he wants to join Miami because of the winning culture in South Beach. I mean, it's...
Great point.
Odom's, the ripples that spread from Odom's one season are just so huge that even though he was only with the Heat for one season and beat out a lot of power forwards who were with the Heat for much longer, those ripple effects make him a top five for sure. Top five and the fifth power forward in our rankings.
Yeah, and despite the fact that of that one year, like you said, not just the ripple effect, but I think his overall attitude here, I think he was really happy. Mm-hmm. We've always known that Odom was, maybe it's been reported that he's a very sensitive type guy. You know, he's had a rough history, a tough childhood, and he really felt wanted here in Miami. And we've seen from him in recent years, his issues off the court. Obviously, we don't want to go too deep into those, but, he wanted to be wanted. And Riley, with the kind of cachet that he has as being, the godfather, what have you, to go out of his way to bring him aboard really meant a lot to him. And I think he was happy here, I think he was legitimately disappointed to be traded to the Lakers, but eventually that turned around because they wound up building a championship winning team there. So, I mean, I think he won 2 titles with the Lakers. So I think overall, I think it wound up panning out pretty well for him. But just the impact he had here, the time that he was able to blend together. And even when he was recently towards the tail end of his career, when he became a free agent, I remember thinking it was a shoo-in for him to come back here, because I think Wade was openly lobbying for him to join the team. And I think, I'm not sure if it was his decision. I can't remember now if it was his decision or the team's decision to go in a different direction. And he didn't wind up re-signing with Miami. But I remember thinking what a great, it would have been a great feeling for him to come back here and kind of build on a success during that one year.
So that's our number 5. I'll let you name off your number 4.
All right. For number 4, I've got longtime Heat power forward Grant Long.
Oh, you're right. Ours are going to be the same. They're going to be the same. Grant Long, 7 seasons in Miami, nearly 12 points per game, 7 rebounds per game between 1988 and 1995. I mean, just one of those guys in just one of those early Heat guys, right, that just keep coming up in these rankings.
Yeah, we talked about it with Keith Askins, being that prototypical 3-and-D guy, but the commitment to the team. And although Grant Long only spent, less than 7 seasons here with the team, he was the original take charge man. I mean, that's actually listed as his nickname at Basketball Reference, which is kind of great. He set the template that we look at other Heat lifers and guys that are committed and willing to do whatever it takes. If you look at the Heat as being a defensive-minded team, a gritty, hardworking team, Long's presence certainly helped create that overall attitude.
Yeah, I mean, just helped establish the attitude, like you said, but then ended up getting traded with Steve Smith for Kevin Willis and a first-round pick that ended up being basically nothing, just a busted pick. So it was kind of weird how that came to an end because Kevin Willis only played, 2 years in Miami?
No, half a season. Just a half a season.
Oh, you're right. Sorry, yeah, just one.
I'm sorry. You're right. The 1.5 season. It was half seasons. Right.
So, I mean, it was weird that the Heat traded Grant Long for him. You'd have to go back and try to figure it out. But Grant Long came in a time before Tim Hardaway, before Alonzo Mourning. And he was just one of the original Heat fan favorites and just one of those guys that, you think about old school Miami Heat teams with, you really think about Alonzo Mourning, right? And just like those fierce defensive, strong teams. But you could even go back further and go with Grant Long. We can move on to number 3 now. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say about Long. I mean, he was, he was part of that team that helped get the Heat into the playoffs and during the start of their franchise. So, I think he's a well-respected player, and he'd had a really long career. He played with Vancouver, Memphis, Atlanta. I think he wound up being at Boston for the last year of his career. But he was a solid rebounder, good scorer, had a good mid-range shot, and he was a good interior presence. And the ability to take charges, I actually looked this up. It turns out that there was some kind of a system in place. I don't know if it was a written rule or an unwritten rule, but I guess more likely an unwritten rule. I looked it up when I was doing a Google search on Grant Long. Apparently, the taking charge, as much as it contributed to team success, he also got rewarded with an offensive play on the other end if you took a charge on defense. So that's why he took as many charges as he did.
Oh, yeah? That's awesome. All right, yeah, the take charge guy. I mean, if we could do probably a top 5 of the best charge takers in Heat history, right? Like, Grant Long, James Posey, Shane Battier. I mean, there's some great charge takers in Heat history. Maybe that's another top 5 we could do.
Coming up with a lot of topics this show.
Yeah, this is a good show. All right, number 3, I got PJ Brown. Big, tall, lanky forward, power forward. Played 4 seasons in Miami during that sweet era between 1996 and 2000. Averaged basically 10 and 8, but probably could have averaged more. Like, if you switched him with Grant Long, probably could have had better averages than Grant Long. I mean, he was a very good shooter. But he was still behind Tim Hardaway, behind Alonzo Mourning. I mean, he was just on that team, right? But he had some really great games in the playoffs. Just one of those guys on that first great era of Miami Heat basketball.
He was a great role player. And, I think that was a part of the thing, was that he really filled an admirable role there. You had Mourning, you had Mashburn later on, you had Hardaway, obviously. But P.J. Brown, I'll never forget Pat Riley complimenting P.J. Brown with the most obscure reference ever. He said, "He's the best weak side help defender in the league." I mean, that's really specific, right? And it just goes to show what kind of help he was able to bring. Obviously Mourning was a rim protector and a block chaser and things like that. He was always a very good defender. If somehow somebody got past Mourning on the way to the rim, P.J. Brown was always there to pick up the slack. And I think the 4 years that he was here in Miami, he was just so ingrained in the success that we enjoyed there with that Riley era, helping them make them the road warriors, the defensive team that we all know and love. And, of course, you can't ignore the fact that he was involved in one of the biggest fights in Heat history and possibly NBA history with Charlie Ward.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be on the list, right? I mean, that's Jeff Van Gundy on the ankles type importance. So,
well, it's a different fight, right? I mean,
right,
but that was
fight. Yeah.
But yeah, no, but yeah, the Charlie Ward one. I mean, I wonder how much Heat fans, longtime Heat fans, probably remember Brown in that context. That's probably the first thing they think of, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, if it's, I remember him more because of his defense. Because I mean, this is a guy that was on all defensive second teams. I remember just his length. He just looked really long out there. I mean, we've talked a little bit about these guys' bodies and maybe how they would transition to the modern NBA. I just have a weird feeling that, like, he would have been, like, guys, like, back in the 90s and 80s, like, big stretch fours that didn't shoot threes, you know, like, Chris Bosh now is, like, shoots threes, like, because teams are asking guys like that to do that. I bet you P.J. Brown could have shot threes, but he just didn't, right? Because that wasn't what players did back then. It's not what power forwards did. I bet you he could have. Like, it would have been cool to see him in today's game.
I don't know. If it's less about stretching the floor like that and more about maybe versatility, he was not a ball handler. He was just a guy who could catch it. If Mourning got caught up on his way to a hook shot at the rim or driving towards the rim, he would kick it out along the baseline, and there would be, you know, P.J. Brown kind of setting him up the same way that another very famous Heat power forward would do later on in his career as well. But, you know, just that baseline jumper was always a steady one. He was a putback guy, a lot of garbage points, but an essential part of it. And again, it's hard to separate with Brown because I think he did have an overall great impact while he was here, even though he wasn't necessarily the most productive power forward. But it's hard to separate him and that team, that defensive presence, because they're just so ingrained. He was such a big part of it. I mean, I think his number was retired by the team, was it not? I think you know, he had a special ceremony here, and he was able to eventually win a title, but I think he's such a special part of this team. I'm not sure how he would have fit in today's league. He would have been
his free throw numbers, and he basically averaged 80% from the free throw line. And
that's impressive.
It's right. So then that, you know, people, like, scouts will always say, if you want to figure out how good of a shooter a guy is, look at his free throw percentage. Because, you know, in a small sample size, which is certainly what P.J. Brown is, I think he took, I mean, I can look at it right here. I got his page up. He took all of 59 three-pointers in his 14-year NBA career, and made 8 of them. So he made only 13% of his threes, but that sample size is so small. I mean, he only shot more than 10 threes in his season twice in his career, and that came in his first three seasons. But as a free throw shooter, he shot 80%. So that leads you to believe that he could stroke the ball, right? So I just think, yeah, you're right. He's not going to be a guy that's going to handle the ball a ton, you know, but you can almost, like Ryan Anderson. Like, Ryan Anderson's not a ball handler. You could park him in the corner, though, and kick it out to him. I always thought it might be kind of neat to see P.J. Brown with his, what is he, like 6'11"? I mean, he's a...
Yeah, he was big.
Six eleven. To have him standing in the corner in certain sets, that would be pretty cool. I bet you he can make the transition. I don't know. That's always just been something that's interested me, though. Guys that used to play, if you ask them to be stretch fours now, if they could do it or not. But that's a whole different conversation.
That was an imposing front line, because he was taller than Mourning by a few inches, to say
the
least.
Yeah.
But yeah, between the two of them, you weren't going to... I mean, he was just... The defense was as good as it was. It was tough scoring against Miami, you know, because of guys like him and Mourning, obviously. But
while Mourning got the... Twice, right? In Miami.
Yeah. While Mourning was, you know, clearly the star of the team and the guy that got all the well-deserved accolades, it doesn't, you know, his job is made a lot easier by having P.J. Brown along there.
Yeah, really, if Chris Bosh is healthy and Hassan Whiteside can fill some of the leaks he has on defense, I mean, Bosh and Whiteside could be very reminiscent of that Brown and Mourning front line.
Yeah, that's a good point. Speaking of Chris Bosh, that's who I have as my number two best power forward in NBA history.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Explain.
Well, I think if I pick Bosh at number two, I think it's pretty obvious who number one is. And
right. Antoine Walker.
I'm sorry?
Antoine Walker.
Oh, I was going to say Michael Beasley, but yeah, either way. maybe before we go into Bosh, we can look at some of those players that we didn't select for the top five.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Kevin Willis a little bit earlier. I guess you have to mention him. Played a season and a half for Miami, though. I mean, you can go around and look at rankings online, and a lot of people will have Kevin Willis in their top five, you know, in these slideshows and things that you could find on the internet. But I think that's maybe looking at Kevin Willis as a whole player and not really his time in Miami. I mean, it was a season and a half, very unimpactful, I would say, or insubstantial. I mean, we talked about Lamar Odom's 1 year, right? But that, like, we explained the ripple effects. There really wasn't that many ripple effects for Kevin Willis, even though they did use him to trade for Tim Hardaway.
Yeah. Yeah, that was probably his, arguably his biggest contribution there. He was there for the last season pre-Riley. He was there for that first year with Riley. He actually played power forward alongside Alonzo Mourning, which is bizarre. I can't picture that lineup in my head because it seems like, you know, both of them, neither of them spread the floor at all.
And just too much body mass.
Yeah, a little bit too much. But yeah, I mean, arguably the most muscular team in the league by far, I guess, between him and Mourning. But I also had Anthony Mason.
Yeah, that's a good one.
He was tough to leave off, the late, great Anthony Mason.
I had the hardest time with. It was Anthony Mason or Lamar Odom.
Yeah, exactly. Mace, you know, I looked at his numbers. They were pretty comparable to Odom's. You know, a guy who was, you know, not as long, lanky, not quite the same ball handler that Odom was, although he was much more skilled than people remember probably, and he was just so big and bulky, so strong. And, you know, he had a great start to his career in New York. You know, Riley kind of found him on the CBA garbage heap, and, you know, he was able to contribute to those really durable Knicks teams. And then he was acquired here, I think, along with the Jamal Mashburn trade, if I'm mistaken. No, that's they traded P.J. Brown and Jamal Mashburn to the Charlotte Hornets, and they got Eddie Jones and Anthony Mason in return. And during that 1 year, he made the All-Star team.
Yeah.
He was a versatile defender. Good rebounder, good low post score. He had that one hatchet move where he would hack at the ball if he tried to bring it into the low post. I'll never forget that. And that was, you know, he had a one good year here. I think, you know, his stint here in Miami ended badly because he had achieved so much success with, you know, Alonzo Mourning being stricken with his kidney disease. And he had basically carried the team on his back. And then when Alonzo came, returned during the end of the year, I think Mason felt very slighted because all of a sudden the attention shifted back into Mourning, and Mason was kind of taken out of it. I think he was even reduced to a bench role, and that kind of took him out of it. And we wound up getting swept later on in the playoffs to the Charlotte Hornets with Mashburn leading the charge. So that was a tough one to swallow. And then he'd leave the team. I think he went to Milwaukee for two seasons afterwards. So that was a really tough one. We mentioned Antoine Walker and Beasley. Both of those guys, you mentioned Walker as a three, but I always thought of him more as the power forward here during that Shaquille O'Neal era. So I looked at the numbers, and he did play most of his minutes as a four. But, I mean, just his ability to stretch the floor, pretty good ball handler himself, and just a fun player to look at.
Antoine Walker in a box, man.
Why would you?
Yeah, I mean, Beasley doesn't make the cut. But
that's an interesting one, though, right? I mean, we can... You know, look, both you and I, along with our love of Deion Waiters and Mario Chalmers, have a soft spot for Michael Beasley. You know, a guy who's, you know, as self-appointed knucklehead, he hasn't always been the smartest player out there. It's fun to watch.
There's a top five Michael Beasleys in Heat history.
There've been a few.
Yeah.
There've been a few. But yeah, he was, you know, very productive in the couple of first years that he was here. You know, he was. I don't think anybody minded trading him away in order to get LeBron James and Chris Bosh here on the roster. So, I mean, but his comeback, it was a good thing to see him come back not once but twice here, and the way that the Heat fans kind of supported him, because, you know, you look at those first 2 years, and then he had his arrest and his troubles, and he had rehab and all these things when he went to Minnesota and Phoenix, and he was definitely a problem child at points there. But when he came back to Miami, especially in the midst of a title run, I think the Heat fan base kind of rallied behind him, and we're really hoping for him to succeed. It just didn't happen.
All right. So you have Chris Bosh at number two.
That was tough. Look, I mean, Chris Bosh, you know, we both feel very strongly about him as a player and a person. We love when he first came here, his sacrifices, the things that he's been willing to do to help get this team to the next level. And you could argue for all of LeBron's individual greatness, no better team player than Bosh during that big three era. His sacrifice to shift positions, to play at the center position, and although he, you know, obviously gained from it, I think he was, you know, it was a hell of a sacrifice for him, because it wasn't just a shifting role, but it was the shift in production, you know, much lesser. It was a tough adjustment, I think, but he made it, and he made it willingly, and he handled it better than anybody could have expected. And the fact that he's able to change his game, to stretch the floor, shoot to three, and you could put him and another player at 1A, 1B, or 1 or 2, whichever role you want to have him in. But to me, I think Bosch has had a great career here, 6 seasons or maybe 5 if you count the half seasons that he's missed. But, you know, really, really great player, arguably one of the best in Heat franchise history. I just felt more strongly about who I have at number one than Bosch at number 2.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned earlier Bosch's decision to re-sign in Miami when LeBron left. I mean, who would have thought that in that first year of the Big Three, within 20 games, people were saying, you got to trade Chris Bosch, it's not working out, that he would be right. The last one of the Big Three standing, right, in Miami. And
good
so,
point.
You know, everything that kind of goes along with that, his quote-unquote sacrifice to move to the center spot after playing power forward his entire career, to do that, to completely change his game from a low post scorer in Toronto to a stretch five who shoots threes and is becomes this incredibly willing defender in the paint and along the perimeter to who really just kind of started this, you know, this mold of like the Karl Anthony Townses and Anthony Davises and all these guys who are fives but can play anywhere along the perimeter all the way into under the rim. I mean, Bosch is so much that and has turned and transformed himself into that. But and for all those reasons, yeah, I mean, he's absolutely up there. I mean, I have him as my number one. You have somebody else as your number one.
Yeah, okay. Udonis Haslem, who I assume you have at number 2.
I have him at number 2. I mean, 13 seasons, Heat lifer. I mean, if you're for just quantity of work, if you're just putting his resume together and submitting it to the Bureau of top 5 Heat power forwards of all time, I mean, his resume is probably thicker than anybody's.
Yeah, I just took that into consideration when I put him at number 1 because I think for all the great production that Bosch has done and all the things that we just talked about, to me, you could argue that Haslem might be the best player in Heat history. And not best in terms of numbers, but just nobody has, I think, been synonymous with the team as much as Udonis Haslem has. The fact that he, look, you maybe could have argued that for Wade, but he left.
Yeah.
And now you could have made that argument for Mourning, but he left too, something that a lot of people conveniently forget. But
it's interesting that you're taking all the leaving part into consideration so much. I think if you look, I mean, not to get too deep into this rabbit hole, but if 50 years from now you look back and on the Heat, I mean, Dwayne Wade I still think is the face of the franchise at that point. I mean, not to take anything away from UD, but I do think I don't think that just because Wade left that he's any less than, you know, the face of the Heat.
Well, which is why he was the number one, you know, shooting guard in our top 5 list. But as far as being the number one power forward, I think Udonis. I mean, look, you know, I know what kind of a player he is. I know his role has been greatly reduced. It's been that way for a long time. But I think you can look at the fact that he's always been there to do whatever's been asked of him. You know, it's guarding Roy Hibbert or trying to put up a big rebound, grab a big rebound towards the end of a game. I mean, you know, he was there during the Shaq era. He was there during that 2003 season we just talked about. He was there during the lean years in between before the Big Three, and he's there now. He's a coach on the floor. He's a coach on the sideline. You know, both you and I have been very, very fortunate to be able to talk to him personally. And what I took from it was, you know, he really understands, you know, the weight of his role here, the importance that he has for Heat fans and how much they love him. The fact that he's from South Florida, he played high school ball here. Yes, he went to UF, but whatever. You know, he is a local boy through and through, and that means a lot to him to be able to play with the same franchise throughout his whole professional career. I expect that'll be the case.
You had to get that gator jab in there, didn't you?
Well, I wish he would have played for UF at the time, but they didn't have much of a program. You know, shout out to Leonard Hamilton, but whatever. I mean, Udonis, I think I can't separate the Heat lifer for all that we've made jokes about and everything else to be so synonymous with the franchise. I couldn't separate that, and that's why I had him at number one.
You get the sense that he really takes the Heat lifer thing seriously as much as we joke about it. Like, that's a very, very important thing to him. And I was legitimately worried when Dwayne Wade left. I mean,
yes,
they talk about each other like brothers so much, and when Wade left, I think we talked about it. I'm not sure if we talked about it on the podcast or not. It's hard to separate it at this point. But you know, what's left for him in Miami if Wade's gone? Is there a reason to stay here? But just the idea of leaving Miami, I mean, he wants to stay here. He is a Heat lifer in the truest sense of the word. That really carries something for him. And I mean, after 13 seasons, after, you know, yeah, he grew up in Miami, played in Florida, played in Gainesville, and ended up having to play overseas for a year because he was, like, really fat, basically, and couldn't make the NBA. Slimmed down, signed with the Heat as an undrafted player. I mean, you look at, like, the Hassan Whitesides and the Tyler Johnsons. This isn't new, you know? This happened back. This happened 13 years ago with Haslam.
Right.
They signed him as an we got to think about that and appreciate it. Signed as an undrafted free agent who was playing in Europe.
Right.
And has played for one team his entire 13-year NBA career. I mean, what undrafted free agent that played in Europe has even had a 13-year career, whether it be a journeyman career or with one team, who has won 3 NBA championships. Has been to 5 NBA finals with the same team. And yes, he was on the bench, but he wasn't, like, for a lot of that time, but he wasn't James Jones for his entire career, right? Like, he was a starter along with Shaquille O'Neal. He had this nasty 15-footer baseline jumper that still sometimes pops up every once in a while, even now. I mean, but he had that mid-range jumper down when that was, like, the extent of what power forwards shot from. You know what I mean? Like, that was stretching the floor back then. So...
And leads the franchise in rebounding. You can't ignore
number
that.
One, I mean, he's by more than 800 rebounds.
No one's
he's
catching
got
him ever.
Lead on that. He's second in games and minutes played, and what was most surprising to me, seventh in points behind only Dwayne Wade, Alonzo Mourning, Glenn Rice, LeBron James, Chris Bosh, and Ronnie Cicely.
Right.
I mean, good company. Seventh.
Yeah, like the rabbit in the hair. He just slow and steady. He just kept producing. You know, after 13 years. And quick question. Which is your favorite version of UD? Is it the current, you know, low crop hair, or the dreads, or the rows?
The cornrows that are dreaded at the end, the long cornrows. That one,
yes,
absolutely, 100%.
Of course, right. I mean, I think that's however.
That's been a while now that he got rid of that, right? That was this first year of the Big Three, or the second year?
I want to say it was the first year. I think with the media scrutiny, maybe it was time to change it up a little bit. I'll have to go back and look. That's an interesting question. I don't know. 2010, 2011, whether or not he was wearing the rose.
And then he switched it to that kind of puffed out, semi-small afro, semi-flat top thing going on. Like, it's almost supposed to be a flat top, but it's a little too poofy to be a flat top.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to style it so much, which is fine. But those cornrows, man. With the long cornrows, with the mouth guard just half hanging out like a cigar. Excellent. Yeah.
And you forget how athletic he was when he started off with the team. I mean, there were some moments there when Wade would kind of dish it to him as he was driving down the paint, and he would finish off with a strong dunk. And I mean, we miss those days, you know, that he can't do that anymore, you know, because he's just been beaten up.
And it's not for lack of good conditioning, right? Like, not too inside baseball, but you and I have seen him in the locker room. That dude,
he's ripped. He's ripped. Yeah. Yeah, and he's working hard before games. I mean, he shoots around, he's running, he's keeping himself. He knows he's not going to get a lot of playing time, so he keeps himself in shape, and no doubt about it. Yeah. And he's an imposing figure, but at the same time, he's also very congenial, right? I mean, very friendly, open with the media, took the time to talk to me personally, and I really appreciated that. And, you know, the fact that he loves Subway, I mean, that just brings him down to earth, right? I mean, how can you ignore that?
Yeah, it'd only be better if you love Miami subs. But who
which
who
they don't even have anymore.
Right, yeah. Wasn't Pitbull supposed to bring that back? I heard something a couple years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
Is he like a part owner in Miami subs now?
Uniquely 305 area, that's right, yeah. Well, he went to school.
Best cheesesteak ever, though. I'm putting that out there. 100%.
He went to school right down the street from where there was a Miami subs on 87th Avenue. Shouts out to Galloway Road, everybody.
So I don't want to take anything away from UD. And it was another hard thing for me, right? Who's number one? Who's number two? And you're right. It really is like a 1A, 1B thing.
Yeah.
And they're both 1A and 1B for completely different reasons, Bosh and Haslam. I mean, Bosh, just because of the sheer talent, the overwhelming ability that he has, and Haslam's just full body of work, right? It's so hard to differentiate between those two. But I ended up with Bosh as my number one just because of the echoes of his career, right? Just the third best player on the very best teams the Heat have ever had. And it, you know, only because a lot of his contributions went unseen. I mean, you could argue in 2014, you know, I don't even think it's an argument. I think it's very factual. 2014, he was the best defender on that team. Better than LeBron, right? Who was always griped that he's never got Defensive Player of the Year considerations. Chris Bosh was the better defender on that in 2014, at least.
Yeah. No, I have no doubt about it. I thought actually LeBron's defense kind of tapered off a lot that last season. Like, yeah, he was a little disinterested. I mean, at the time I was beaten up for it, but I actually said that he was, you know, that he was already kind of checking out a little bit. He was frustrated with the system, and I thought he was going to leave, and then he did, and then everybody was like, "Oh, maybe you were right." But
that's neither here nor there. But just I mean, that's really, you know, the whole big three thing was just so large, and Bosch was such a major part of that, not only in the Heat's history but just NBA history. So to me, I just think that the huge weight behind the big three thing,
yeah,
you know, just kind of elevates Bosch over Haslam as far as the top five rankings of all time. But, you know, honestly, like, it's hard, right? It's hard to pick between the two, and I'm okay with Haslam at number one, Bosch at number one. Doesn't matter to me. But I ended up, that was my argument why Bosch was number one, just because of the sheer weight of his career and just the echoes of his decision in 2010 and everything that he's done, you know, NBA-wise, league-wide, just
sure,
is so loud that I just had to put him at number one.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think you can't go wrong with either choice. But if you disagree with us, to all of our listeners, feel free to reach out to us. Let us know via Twitter or email us. We want to hear from you. If you have any other player that you think deserves to be in the top five, let us know. You know, we're always interested in hearing back from you, getting feedback, and we're always taking questions when we do our Monday mailbag. So as always, let us know what you think of the show, and keep in touch with us.
Yeah, especially if you have a Michael Beasley argument. Love to hear it.
Absolutely.
Well, that's all we got for today. Whether you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, thank you for listening. You can get in touch with the show on Twitter at LockedOnHeat or by email, or you can send us mailbag questions or just say hi. That's LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. Thanks for joining me, David.
Absolutely, Wes.
We'll catch you next time. Hey, it's me again. Thanks for listening to the show, and if you like what you heard, do us a favor and go to iTunes, leave us a rating, and even a review. It really does help. Also, if you're an advertiser looking to sponsor Locked On Heat, send us an email at lockedonheat@gmail.com. And shout out again to our sponsor, SeatGeek, the easiest app for buying and selling tickets. Download the app and use the promo code LOHEAT, that's LOHEAT, to get $20 back after you've made your very first ticket purchase.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.